This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today you're in for a treat, since I have right here in the studio with me the one and only Howard Zinn. Most famous for his People's History of the United States, Zinn is a professor emeritus at Boston University. The historian, playwright, and social activist has been prolific over the last 10 to 15 years, writing practically another bookshelf full. His plays include Emma and Marx in Soho. His memoir, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, is a terrific book. And his latest works include Voices of a People's History with Anthony Aronoff, The People Speak, Artists in Times of War, Original Zinn, and you're going to have to forgive that pun, I think it was from David Barsamian, the interviewer, Just War, and his latest, which is just coming out in a month or so, A Power Governments Cannot Suppress. I'm partial to Howard Zinn not only for these monumental contributions, but because he's been gracing the pages of The Progressive with a regular column over the past decade, and he's been a real delight to work with. Howard Zinn, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
How have you found such a source of productivity over these last few years? What do you eat for breakfast?
That's the question I usually ask when they're doing a sound check. But so is everything on this program going to be a sound check?
I
have hot cereal in the morning.
And this is an oatmeal commercial.
Not just oatmeal. Have you ever heard of Maltex?
You're
in for a treat.
So that's the secret, Maltex. I'll have to check that one out. Tell me about your writing habits. Are you a daily writer?
No. I'm a very undisciplined, sporadic, anarchic writer. I know there are professional writers who make me feel inadequate because they say, I get up at 6 o'clock every morning. I work until 2, No, I don't do that. I get up late. It's late getting started. I work in bursts, let's put it that way. There are days when I don't write at all. When I have a deadline.
Well, I like to give you deadlines.
And you are the guy who gives me deadlines. You see, when I have a deadline, I'll laze around and not do anything until 24 hours before my deadline, and then I'll just work nonstop, day and night, until I have something that could please even the editor of The Progressive.
Oh, God, I'm stealing you your sleep. Don't tell my wife. She'll be mad at me. Listen, you have become a bit of a cultural totem, not even just on the left. You were in Good Will Hunting, at least your book was. And then I read in this David Barsamian Original Zinn that you also made a cameo, your book did anyway, in The Sopranos. Tony Soprano didn't like the way you talked about Columbus, evidently.
Well, yeah, I did not see that episode of The Sopranos, but everybody else in the country saw the episode, and they said, well, there was a scene where I guess it's Tony Soprano's son who's in college, and he comes home with a copy of A People's History of the United States, lays it on a table, and Tony Soprano goes bananas.
What it said in the book, Original Zinn, was that Tony Soprano came to the defense of Christopher Columbus and said, I don't care what this man in this book says, Christopher Columbus is still my hero. You've done more to expose Christopher Columbus than maybe anybody else. How did you get started on that?
Well, I got started on it simply out of my own ignorance. That is, I learned about Columbus the way everybody else in the American educational system learns about Columbus, Columbus the hero, Columbus the great navigator. But then when I decided to write a people's history of the United States, I knew I had to start with Columbus. That's where history books start. We're very ignorant of that long history of this continent, of this hemisphere, before Columbus. But I start with Columbus, and then since I already knew that I wanted to write this history from the standpoint of the people not who are the conquerors, but who are the conquered, who are the victims, who are the resistors to conquest, I thought, well, who are those people? Where are they? I don't want to just quote Columbus. Well, of course, the indigenous people that he encountered in the Bahamas, they did not have a writing culture. And, in fact, most of them had been destroyed. There was very little left of that Indian civilization. But I found the Spanish priest, Bartolomé de las Casas, who was there at the time, who saw what happened, who wrote it down in volume after volume, History of the Indies. And I educated myself so that I could then transfer my education to people who were reading my book. And I informed them of what I had learned, that Columbus was, well, to put it bluntly, the first Western imperialist in this hemisphere. And he wanted gold. He wasn't just a nice navigator, scientific person. He wanted gold, and he was willing to kill and mutilate and kidnap Indians in order to get that gold. So that's the story I told, and it's probably the most startling thing in my book, precisely because most Americans have learned about Columbus the way I learned about Columbus, and so it astonishes them to hear one of the heroes taken down. But to me, what's important, well, there are many things that are important about it, but one of the things that's important about it is if you start to be skeptical about the historical education that you have received, if you start to be skeptical about one episode, like the Columbus episode, you're likely to ask yourself, oh, in fact, as a young girl on the West Coast who first learned about Columbus said to her teacher, what else have they lied to me about?
Was that colonial experience, the colonial attitude, the imperialist attitude, as you put it, Howard Zinn, of Columbus, has that been emblematic through our history?
Well, you can find a thread running from Columbus up through the colonial period. Well, you can right up to the coming of the Mayflower people, the settlement of Jamestown, because what happens immediately, they begin to act as if this land, this continent, belongs to them. They begin to act as if the Indians, who had lived here for a very, very long time and actually created an interesting civilization, they begin to act as if these Indians don't deserve to have their own land. And so they go on rampages and massacres against the Indians. So that, and of course, that goes on into the 18th, 19th century until those hundreds and hundreds of Indian tribes are driven out of this continent. And then, of course, the imperial... this imperial drive, which first takes the Americans across the continent, then takes them into the Caribbean at the turn of the beginning of the 20th century, takes them into the Pacific, takes them into Central America, and of course, after World War II, has taken the United States government all over the world. Now, we have replaced all the previous empires, the British Empire, the Dutch Empire, the French Empire, the German Empire, the Russian Empire. We have replaced them all. We are number one, as some people say proudly, as I say with sadness.
All those empires fell. The U.S. Empire will fall, too. Do you foresee that in the near future?
Well, I'm not giving dates, but it will. It will fall. I think it's already begun to fall. I don't know when to date it from. Maybe Vietnam. That is, Vietnam was the first obvious colossal defeat for the American Empire. And in fact, every administration since the administrations of Vietnam, every administration has been trying to overcome that by going into war after war and moving our troops here and there, Panama, Grenada, and Middle East. But you can see what's happening now in Iraq. Military power has severe limits to it. It cannot conquer a people who are determined not to be conquered. And the previous empires, the Roman Empire and the other empires, they all overextended themselves, and they began to take the wealth of their people and waste it, spend it on war and militarism, and they collapsed. And I think the American Empire is in an early state of collapse, and I'll be happy when it collapses.
What is going to happen in Iraq? I mean, it looks like President Bush wants to stay there and just pass the bloody baton on to the next president. Do you think he'll be able to do that?
Well, he will try. He seems impervious to the public. He's impervious to the public in Iraq, obviously, because we know now that the polls in Iraq again and again show 60, 70, 80% of the Iraqis do not want the American soldiers there. But Bush is also impervious to public opinion in the United States, which has now turned very sharply against the war. And Bush and Cheney and the rest of his administration just ignore that. So I suspect that Bush may, in fact, continue this occupation until the end of his regime. My hope is that the president who follows him, whether it's Republican or Democrat, although it's more likely to happen with a Democrat, but my hope is that the Democrats, if they come to power, although Democrats in their history have not been averse to imperialism, Democratic presidents have been just as expansionist and militaristic as Republicans, but the Democrats, with constituents that are different than the Republicans, with constituents to answer to, who certainly do not want the United States to stay in Iraq, a new Democratic president may be more sensitive to public opinion. You know, presidents, whatever drive they have towards power and wealth, at certain points become aware that their power is shaky if the public turns against them. And so my hope is that a Democratic administration coming in will take us out of Iraq as fast as possible.
I mean, the imperviousness of Bush, as you put it, is one of the peculiarities, I think, of this administration, Howard Zinn. What is the what distinguishes it from its predecessors? You wrote in one of these books that the Bush administration is more ruthless, more dangerous, more tied to corporate power, more militarist, more ambitious to seize control and influence all over the world than its predecessors. Is you know, what is the continuity between past presidents that have engaged in imperial wars, and what is the uniqueness of this one?
Well, of course, yes, it is a continuity. You know, the Bush drive into the Middle East is a continuation. You may remember that Carter, who now is, well, a different kind of person now than when he was president, you know, human rights and global values in negotiation and not war. But Carter, when he was president, enunciated what is called the Carter Doctrine, saying that the United States must see to it that no one else controls the oil of the Middle East, and we will go to any lengths, including armed force, to make sure that that oil does not fall out of our control. So there's a continuity, Democrats, Republicans, it doesn't matter, a continuity all through American history and certainly into this century. And so, yes, Bush is part of that continuity, but at the same time, it is, well, as you were suggesting, different and more ruthless. And why is this? I'll try to explain. I'll try to explain as if I know the answer. I'm guessing, you see, at why. And I think maybe it's because it finds no real opposition in this country. No opposition in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has never been weaker. It's never been more pusillanimous. I always wanted to use that word, pusillanimous, in public, so here's my chance. The Democratic Party has been pitiful as an opposition party. And so if you have no opposition party, you have nobody calling you to account you will move ahead in the way the Bush administration has. Plus, the press, like the Democratic Party, has laid down and cowered before the Bush administration, as the press historically has done. There, too, there's a continuity. That is that historically the press has been subservient to governmental power. But the press these days is even more subservient.
I read, I think, in the bound galleys of your new book, A Power Governments Cannot Suppress, Howard Zinn, that Henry David Thoreau criticized the media, saying to one columnist, "I can hear the sewers rumbling through every inch of your column." So there's some continuity there as well. The other thing that about the Bush administration, other than the media here and the cowardly Democratic Party, is that there's no check in foreign affairs. There's no Soviet Union. There's no competing power.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true. The Soviet Union was something of a check. Well, sometimes I think that has been exaggerated. That is, the existence of the Soviet Union with all its nuclear weapons and did not stop the United States from going into Vietnam, did not stop the United States from overthrowing governments in Guatemala and Chile. So, I don't place a lot of emphasis on that.
Well, what should we do now? I mean, we can't just sit here and wait 2 years until Bush leaves office.
No. No, we'd better not. We'd better not. I think, although it's true, as I said, that Bush seems to be impervious to public opinion, and I talked about the fact that he can do this because of the Democratic Party and the press not really constituting an opposition. I think there needs to be a rebellion inside the Democratic Party to tell the members of the Democratic Party that they will not be voted into office. People will stay away from the polls, but they will not be voted into office unless they pledge to get out of Iraq. And in fact, I believe that there are people who are circulating such a pledge, who suggested that people actually signed a pledge saying, "I will not vote for any presidential candidate or any congressional candidate unless that candidate says he will remove our troops from Iraq." So we need to do all we can to call the Democratic Party to account, in other words, to try to move the dominoes that finally move the administration. Those dominoes include the Democratic Party, they include the press, they include the church, and after all, the church, at least a certain part of the church, played an important part in the civil rights movement, in the anti-war movement, and I think so many Americans still go to church. In spite of Bush, I imagine that when Bush started going to church, a lot of people decided they wouldn't go to church. But despite him, people are going to church. Despite Bush's affirmation that God tells him what to do, people seem to still believe in God. And I believe that that the church can play a role. And so it's a matter – people must do whatever they can, understanding that it's an uphill fight, but – people must join rallies. I mean, there are rallies and there are vigils. There are groups all over this country. They're not reported in the press, and so people don't know about them, but all over this country. And I would guess that whoever is listening to this program, somebody in your neighborhood is doing something. There's something happening in your neighborhood which will give you a chance to express yourself. And also write letters to your local newspaper. And let your voice be heard. Every little action, I think this is very important to stress, every small action is important because at certain points in history, these small actions add up and change takes place.
This is what I call a Howard Zinn volcanic theory of social change, that the change suddenly and unpredictably erupts. And certainly we need to push or breathe on that volcano, if you can do that. I don't think you can metaphorically, but I tried. You mentioned Bush thinking that God put him in the Oval Office. Mm. This is his messianic militarism. This, too, goes throughout U.S. history, or at least back to McKinley, anyway, as far as presidents. Do you trace that?
Oh, yeah. It's very interesting. We talk about separation of church and state, which is a great myth, of course, because leaders in this country have always invoked God. I mean, right from the beginning, the Puritans of New England, Governor Winthrop of Massachusetts, in the 1830s, the newspaper O'Sullivan, who talked about manifest destinies, you know, giving us the right to go into Mexico and wherever we wanted to go, and talked about how Providence has allotted to us. He wasn't talking about the city of Providence, Rhode Island. He was talking about the real Providence, heaven, God. The Providence has allotted to, you know, us, the American people, the right to go here and go there. So, and that too has been, by the way, bipartisan. The Democrats, Wilson invoked God, Clinton invoked God. Really, it's just there, too, like with everything else. Bush has just carried it further. Bush has made it more specific. I don't know of any other president. Well, maybe McKinley, as you mentioned, McKinley. McKinley said, yes, God told me to take the Philippines. The other presidents have been more modest. You know, they didn't get very specific policy instructions from God, whereas Bush obviously has, because he told somebody, God told me to go after Al-Qaeda. Then God told me to go into Iraq. I can just see God with a map, you know, with a pointer, and giving that instruction.
It is amazing to think that he is getting the word on high constantly, Howard Zinn. One of the articles you wrote for The Progressive that's in one of your books that I cherish the most is the one on nationalism, the one on patriotism, where you say we should renounce nationalism and all its symbols, its flags, its pledges of allegiance, its anthems, its insistence in song that God must single out America to be blessed. I agree with you 100% on that, but this is such a hard battle to win with our fellow citizens who are from very young age imbued with this sense that we're the greatest country on earth.
It is a hard battle to win. Because, as you say, we're all of us, you know, from the very first years of our existence, pledging allegiance and saluting the flag and all of that. And yet, there are counterforces in our culture, in our lives. And there's such a thing as love thy neighbor. And thy neighbor is not just the people in this country. The exhortation to love your neighbor doesn't stop at the water's edge. And Americans do care. When something happens in another country, people suffer from an earthquake in Southeast Asia. Americans care about what happens to people in other countries. And in other words, I think there is a fundamental human compassion which goes deeper than nationalism. Nationalism is taught. Human compassion, I don't think that has to be taught. I really believe, and don't ask me to give you genetic proof of this, but I really believe that people naturally have a kinship with other people, and nations are not natural. National boundaries are not natural. They're artificial. They can be overcome.
I mean, Europe has been overcoming some of those national boundaries, but here it seems the boundaries, both metaphorically and also very literally, with the fence along the border now in Mexico, are becoming wider and stronger and higher.
It's shameful. 700-mile wall along our southern border to keep out of this country the people, the Mexicans, from whom we stole that land in the Mexican War. And I find this, that when the immigration issue comes up and people say, well, immigrants are doing this, they're taking this away from us, and I don't argue with them about, you know, the economics of immigration. There are statistics, you know, that show that immigration doesn't hurt the American economy. I try to appeal to people's sense of humanity. Those people coming across the border, they are human beings. They are like your father, your grandfather, your great They also came to this country. The Indians didn't set up a wall along the Atlantic Ocean to keep the European immigrants out. They came. And I think when you appeal to people's humanity, it can overcome all the cheap talk of politicians.
Boy, I sure hope so. I mean, you are kind of the apostle of optimism on the left, and there's so many people who are the apostles of doom who seem to take comfort in our powerlessness and see every dark cloud out there in the sky. To what do you attribute this optimism?
Poor eyesight. I don't think I'm foolishly optimistic. Who would confess to being foolishly optimistic? I don't think I'm. By that I mean my optimism is not based on, oh, everything is going to be great tomorrow or next week or next month. It's a long-term optimism. I recognize that in a short term we may go through tougher, worse times than we are going through now. But it's a long-term optimism based on history, based on the fact that I know that people through history and other places and here in this country have gone through terrible things that have lasted for decades and decades. Look how long slavery lasted. And look how long it took for an anti-slavery movement to develop. But my optimism is based on the fact, on something I said before, that I think that people are basically decent, that people have common sense. They can be deceived for a while. But when they begin to learn, when the truth begins to make its way through the apertures of disinformation and lies, people do wake up and change, and we've seen this historically. So this, my optimism is grounded on history. It's grounded on my belief in the fundamental decency of human, you know, beings all over the world. And, it's a rational optimism, I insist.
Maybe a constitutional one, though. Not maybe our Constitution itself, but your own peculiar personal constitution.
Are you looking at me and finding my constitution is peculiar?
Look through that. You say that there's a zigzag toward a more decent society. Do you really think the arc is in that direction, or can we take a different trajectory?
Well, the zigzag, if I said it, is a simplification. I can't believe that I said anything simplistic. But zigzag is one line that goes back and forth. But I actually believe there are two lines that are operating, and one line is the line of public policy, which zigzags and zigzags. The other line is the line of social consciousness, and very often the line that is evident, that is obvious, of what the government is doing, that line crowds out and obscures something else that's happening, and that is that people beneath the surface of policy are getting restive, are becoming indignant, are learning. And so that is the line that I see, and it makes me feel fairly confident about a future.
Well, here's to restiveness and indignation, Howard Zinn. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.